Views expressed are not endorsed by the United States Department of Defense or its components. Welcome back to the Flyover Podcast as part of USAFA Aviation. Today is episode 19, and we are privileged to have Major Mark Rage Favinger with us today. He is the Air Officer Commanding of Cadet Squadron 2 at the United States Air Force Academy in Colorado, and also serves as a T-53A instructor pilot with the 306th Flying Training Group at USAFA. Major Favinger graduated from the U.S. Air Force Academy in 2010.
His first assignment was as a T-6A instructor pilot in the 33rd Flying Training Squadron at Vance Air Force Base, Oklahoma. He served as evaluator pilot in the B-52H at Minot Air Force Base, North Dakota. Major Favinger was selected for a commander's program that helped develop future nuclear enterprise leaders through educational experiential opportunities focusing on Air Force nuclear enterprise programming and acquisition strategies, future long-range strike priorities, strategic weapons effects, multi-domain operations, nuclear command and control, and leadership development. Major Favinger served as the aide-de-camp to the Commander Air Force Global Strike Command at Barksdale Air Force Base, Louisiana. Prior to this assignment, Major Favinger instructed students in B-52H flight operations, providing combat crews to two bomb wings ready to deploy in support of national objectives. Additionally, he managed training operations for the squadron's instructor cadre. Major Favinger has flown in support of Operations Inherent Resolve and Freedom Sentinel, as well as numerous higher headquarters directed missions. He's flown missions in forward deployed locations such as Al Udeid Air Base, Qatar, and Anderson Air Force Base, Guam. He's a senior pilot with more than 2,700 hours. Welcome to the show, sir.
Hey guys, thanks for having me.
So I guess we'll kind of go straight into your flying career and the B-52. So fundamentally, what does the B-52 provide for the Air Force, and what is its current role today?
So the B-52 provides a little bit of everything. Everything from nuclear strike capabilities with the ALCM, so the air-launched cruise missile, strategic attack with the JASSM, so the joint air-to-surface standoff missile, and the MALD miniature air-launched decoy. In addition to, we can do direct attack, in theory, close air support, or at least a variant of that, not quite your A-10 flavor of CAS, but the B-52 version. We can do non-traditional ISR. We have a significant mining operation as well, so dropping naval mines on behalf of the Navy. We can do information operations, so dropping leaflet canisters, if you will, kind of doing some of that stuff, deterring or trying to pass that information to the adversary that they need to get away, or for civilian sector folks to not support potential adversaries. So a little bit of everything is what the B-52 is capable of doing. What it's really, effective at right now is that strategic and nuclear attack and deterrence as a byproduct of that. So the nuclear mission with the air-launched cruise missile, the AGM-86 Bravo, is a legacy missile, meaning it's been around for a long time. But that is kind of the bedrock of all, the DoD strategy is nuclear deterrence, and we're one of the legs of that deterrence triad, with the others being the ground-based ICBMs, or intercontinental ballistic missiles, and then the sea-launched ballistic missiles from the Navy. So that's kind of mission one, and then the strategic attack that goes with that is the standoff capabilities with the JASSM and MALD, and then all the other, everything else is kind of secondary to those key, that's kind of what the role that they're going to play in a future peer-level fight.
Yeah, so you mentioned, what were those Navy mines that you were mentioning? Yeah. Or, like, what is that?
So it's essentially, the Mark 62, Mark 65, it's kind of your conventional bomb body, but it's basically, it's not, the big bulbous mines that you would picture from, like, old school movies, but it's just a mine that we would drop in the water. What's unique about that is any mine that we drop, we have to be able to go out and recover. So we have to be, it's a gravity dropped weapon right now. They're working on developing and implementing JDAM tail kits on them, which will help that recovery process. But right now it's naval mining, like I said. So it's the Navy is the primary customer that we're serving in that sense. But the rough equivalent would be a formation of B-52s can drop roughly what a squadron of F-18s could go out and drop for mining. So it's thinking just the whole mission of a minefield in the water is naval deterrence. So think if you've got a strait that you don't want ships to cross, we drop mines in there and we want to be fairly visible in doing so. Like, the goal is not to destroy ships, it's to deter folks from crossing those bodies of water.
And when's the last time, like, Navy mines have been used in combat?
Ooh. I don't know the answer to that. It's kind of a back burner mission for us. We practice it, but it's not, like I said, it's not a key mission. It's something that our air crews we train for, and it's a qualification that we maintain, but it's not something that we're going out there thinking on a night one capability. It's definitely after the IADs have been taken down and trying to deter future operations.
But if the Navy needs your help,
hey, we're here.
Ready to do it.
Sweet. So going back to another one of the B-52s mentions, that nuclear triad portion, that's your capability number one.
Yeah.
How is it training for something that important compared to the CAS mission, the kind of stuff you've had to flex into with the war on terror and that kind of thing?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, nuclear ops is definitely one of those things. Like I said, it is the bedrock to our nation's defense. So the nuclear posture review, everything that's outlined in that is in support of the national defense strategy. And that nuclear deterrence is kind of the foundational piece to enabling everything else that we do. And so it's, if you've ever heard of the long piece, you guys in the history department are probably familiar, but the idea that we haven't had a major large scale conflict since World War II, a lot of, proxy state effects and those types of things. But the idea there is having a capable and credible nuclear deterrent force has deterred any kind of large scale nuclear conflict. So, like I said, we're flying with the Alcom missiles, which is, I believe, a product of the 1970s, so way past its original service life. But the air leg of the triad is really where, so we've got the B-52 launching the air-launched cruise missiles, and then the B-2 with more of a penetrating strike capability. And with the air leg of the triad, you get the flexibility that goes with that. So it can be very flexible in the sense that we can launch bombers, and then we can recall them prior to any kind of launch being affected. And then it's also very visible in the sense that the adversary is likely going to know when we're loading up weapons. And so even the act of pulling weapons out of our storage areas, loading them on the B-52 has a deterrent effect. So it's visible, it's flexible, compared to the other two legs, where you've got the immediate response of the ICBMs, so the International Continental Ballistic Missiles, and then you have the survivable leg with the SSBNs, the submarine launched ballistic missiles.
Yeah. Okay. Sweet. So when we talk about the nuclear mission of the B-52, we ask this to the B-2 pilot. We did not ask it to General Clark, but the B-52, like, if pilots were to go, what would have to happen for pilots to be able to go rogue? Or, like, what's the process like? What are the safeguards to prevent that from happening?
Yeah. So, I mean, some of it is, processes are classified, obviously. But ultimately, there's only one person that can order that strike, and then it's going to come down through the different governmental wickets. But so everything that we get comes in through message traffic, if you will. So that can be voice or printed. And so we will never have less than a two-person crew, right? And so it's the B-2, right, is the current nuclear capability as far as the penetrating, with the B-21 coming online, and it's two-person crew because you've got that two-person concept. So no one person can go rogue in that sense. And that same thing on an ICBM crew. You've always got your crew commander and then the secondary, and so it's they have to turn keys together. And so for us, when that message traffic comes down, that's what's going to give us kind of our unlocks, if you will, to enable us to actually arm the weapon and then to actually release it. Without those unlocks, which is all kind of scrambled, garbled, coded language, we're essentially carrying shapes in that sense. So so the idea that you're going to have a crew go rogue is not the case at all. Like there's so many preventative steps in there. And it's not just the rogue crew isn't the same or isn't the primary concern in that. There's also, right, safety mishaps. And I forget what the exact threshold is, but the idea is that there's definitely like hard links and weak links or soft links that are preventing things that, the hard links being you have to do A to enable B to enable C, and you have to go through these deliberate steps to arm the weapon. And that's kind of the preventative things that I was mentioning earlier. And then you have weak links that, hey, if the weapon, let's say, was jettisoned or, accidentally, like a mishap happens, let's say you're loading it and it falls, something like that. It's those weak links that they're designed to break that chain so that, in theory, like I said, they're very safe, reliable, and effective. And all of that goes into the capability and credibility aspect of having competent maintainers, competent air crew that can go out and affect this mission if our nation calls, while at the same time being able to deter our adversaries and communicate that through an effective crew force, effective maintainers, effective weapons. Even though they are old, they're still resilient and effective, and then being able to communicate that to our adversaries.
And to circle back to one of the other things you mentioned, the B-52 being capable of doing so, CAS. I've never heard that before, that the B-52 does that. So, how does the B-52 do CAS?
So it's basically, bombs on call, right? We're not down in the weeds the way the A-10, I kind of joked about that earlier. We're not down there, we can't do the forward air controller airborne mission the way that an A-10 can basically control the stack, and they're right there working, they can see the JTAC. So we're always going to be up at altitude. So typically, we're great at operating up in the 30s in different, for different missions. That's 30,000 feet. For CAS, we like to be more in the 20s where we've got better pod footage fidelity. But it's essentially, we've got bombs on call, like I said. So, on one wing, we can carry 8 500-pound JDAM. On the other wing, we could do a mixed load and have 6 2,000-pounders, or we could do 8 and 8 or 6 and 6. And then we can have 8 weapons in the internal rotary bay. all total, we could have 24 500-pound JDAM weapons, or I guess 20 2,000-pounders.
So a version of it could look like literally the Army guys need air support and there's a B-52 overhead calling in.
Yeah.
And they're calling in coordinates.
And so those were I had the ability to deploy and support operations Inherent Resolve and Freedom Sentinel. So that's Iraq and Syria and then Afghanistan. And that was basically it, where we had 3 B-52s airborne on every day over the course of an 8-month deployment. And we were the 4th B-52 squadron to rotate through Al Udeid and support CENTCOM in that mission or in those operations. And so, like I said, we had essentially it was 6 hours of on time, what we call vol period, vulnerability window, where we're overhead for 6 hours, and then we kind of do a swap out with the next B-52 that's coming up the boulevard or the avenue. So, in every 24-hour period for those 8 months, we had 18 hours of B-52s on station with anywhere from, like I said, 20 to 24 weapons on hand. That, and we can do bomb on coordinate where the JTACs can call in and say, hey, we need a 500-pound weapon on this target, and we can release that. Or we can do bomb on target, where we're, identifying targets with our pod footage based on, a target talk on that the JTACs are saying, and then we can designate those coordinates ourselves. It's still going through the coordination process, and it's still an approved, vetted target. We're doing collateral scans, and we're doing everything we can to prevent any kind of, collateral damage there. But, yeah, it's, like I said, it's bombs on call.
Yeah, no big gun like the A-10, but still plenty of effects.
For sure, yeah.
Any specific time you were helping out ground forces that particularly sits in your mind? Or?
So we were, when we were over there, it was our sister squadron out of Minot, the 23rd Bomb Squadron. They were there for some of the significant events, in Mosul and Raqqa and some of those operations. And then we were there towards the end of the conflict. We were actually there when President Trump declared victory over ISIS in Iraq. So that was kind of something we could hang our hat on. We spent a lot of time doing kind of like what I said, we call NAI scans. So basically area of interest scans, where we're doing a lot of pod footage stuff. There was a couple sorties where we got to, I think, support some of the troops on the ground and do some good things. There's one that stood out where we got integrating with some Marine F-18 Hornets out of the Gulf that they came up, and we were, tracking ISIS folks as they were driving down a corridor, and it was a multi-vehicle type engagement. So some things like that, but, it's not the specific, strikes or those things. It was really kind of just working with the team that we had deployed. So 6 jets, working with the crews that we had, and had a brand new navigator that was fresh out of MQT. So he had gotten to Minot, went through MQT, and then within a month was deploying with us. My co-pilot was in the same class. So I was a brand new instructor pilot in the buff. We had an instructor radar navigator that was on our crew, and then a electronic war thruster that I think had a little bit more seasoning, but she was definitely not an instructor yet. So relatively young crew, and the 5 of us going out there and you know, essentially that co-pilot getting to go from struggling to get the gas and, you know, trying to develop the crew that we had, whether it was, like I said, the co-pilot getting the gas, our navigator being competent with their weapon systems and setting him up to where he's got the aviation skills and the time in the seat to upgrade. And he was set up to become a radar navigator when we got home. And how do we take this random group of five people and train and work hard and develop each other to become the best, you know, bomb squadron in the best bomb crew in the squadron. So that was always kind of the goal.
Yeah. So the B-52 is an old aircraft.
Yeah.
And so what's it like flying the B-52 compared to, say, newer bombers, the B-1, B-2, soon to be the B-21?
Yeah. So I don't have a frame of reference, right? I've never flown a B-1, a B-2. So want to make sure they get their credit where credit is due. But it's definitely, you know, you're flying a piece of history. So the original flight of the B-52 was in 1952. And so then here we are, all the models that we're flying right now are H models. So they were all procured in 1960 and 61, right? So here we are, you know, pushing, what is that, 70, 65 years later, something like that. So they're definitely, you know, old school platforms. Some of it is, you know, you jump into it, and even some of the things that we do, like there's no engine data monitoring, is in the sense like automated. But so it's a little bit more workload on the crew, and some of that could seem archaic, but it's also, you know, there's great pride to be had in doing difficult things well. So I think that was one of the best parts, was just knowing that like there's generations of air crew that have come before us, and the strong heritage that they've built in the squadrons, and kind of picking up that torch and running with it. But it's also one of those things of knowing, hey, it's a, you know, 70-year-old airframe, but it's still very capable, right? We're not going out there and thinking, oh, we can't max perform this aircraft. So much of that comes down to knowing your weapon system and being able to jump in there, you know, and max perform that to the way we can go out there and still affect the mission. There's also the upgrades that are coming down the pike too, right? So there's the CERP, the Commercial Engine Replacement Program, which, so it's an engine replacement. I believe it's the Rolls-Royce F-130 that they're putting on there. So in roughly the same nacelle size. So there's, you know, not as much testing that's going to need to be done with that, but it's going to basically lead to a B-52J model. So with new engines, it's probably new generators, new fuel systems, all new capabilities, new avionics and cockpit, essentially. So, and that's going to open the door to different crew configurations, weapons, that we can carry on there. So that is going to be a force multiplier as far as that goes, and extend the longevity of the B-52 into the 2040s and potentially beyond, while also increasing its capability to support the mission. So it's the B-52J model, and then the B-21 is coming online, right? So in the meantime, like you mentioned, the B-1 and B-2, those programs are set to sunset here over the next decade or so, or probably shorter. Some of that is, you know, maintenance rates. The B-52 is just, like I said, it's a 70-year-old aircraft, but it was over-engineered by, you know, for all rights and purposes there. So, or all intents and purposes. So, just over-engineered, very resilient, very maintenance-friendly in that sense. And some of it is accessibility. The B-2, it's now, the stealth technology is primarily out of the 80s. So it's come to the end of its lifespan too. So, as they sunset the B-1, B-2 programs, it'll be the B-21 and the B-52 going forward. So it's a new and exciting future, I think, for both platforms.
So when you're flying, especially as we come into this kind of new age of strategic competition here, now it's the B-2 and the B-52 and the B-1 working together. Mm-hmm. But in the future, the B-21 and the B-52 working together, how do those penetrator roles and the standoff role complement each other, like in a practical flying sense? If you go to a red flag, what's one doing, what's the other doing, that kind of thing?
So it's very, you know, each airframe has their own capabilities, and that's going to go across the Air Force, right? And so the B-52 is really that standoff role. And so whether that's on the nuclear side or on the conventional side, and even, you know, as hypersonics come online, that's some of the flexibility with the B-52 having external hard points, is it can accept varying, you know, shapes and capacities of weapons. So even as a test platform and as a onboarding for future air, you know, air platform or air weapons, that there's a whole, you know, untapped potential there. And so the B-52, and just with that flexibility, and they can see it from a mile away, right? When we talk about threat doctrine, I guess, we always figured that we look like we're a 100-square-meter target, right? We're basically, I mean, we're the size of a football field or thereabouts. So they're going to see us from a long ways away, but it's the unrefueled range that we have. So typically we're talking about 7,000 miles unrefueled. So, you know, with a couple air refuelings, we can get in theater relatively with some relative flexibility. And then the engine replacements will add to that with its flexibility or with the increased efficiency of the new engines. And so, you know, our ability to get into theater and then the weapons that we carry have their own standoff range. And so being able to engage targets from a standoff distance, that's going to be some of the capabilities that we have specifically. And so we don't need that capability to penetrate. That's where the B-2 and then eventually the B-21 will really flex that. And so it's that complementary role. And then also in who's engaging who and what the stages of the conflict are. So in the sense that, you know, we'll likely be, if you're familiar with the Secret Squirrel mission back in the Gulf War, where they took off a little over a half dozen B-52s from Barksdale Air Force Base in Louisiana, flew them across the world, and then they were there on night one of the Iraqi IADS takedown or the Integrated Right. Air Defense System. And then they flew them all home and nobody knew about it for the better part of a decade, right? The Secret Squirrel mission. So, and that Sweet. Was the first engagement of the CALCM, the conventional air launched cruise missile. So the non-nuclear version of the same, platform. So, that type of thing where IADS take down, for the B-52 kind of in that standoff role. And then the B-2, eventually the B-21 going in with, you know, F-22, F-35 support will kind of, engage more close up.
And so when we talk like the B-52, and so right, so the B-21's coming online, B-2, B-1 are going away soon. Mm-hmm. B-52 is eventually going to have to go away. Say 2040s, 2050s, who knows?
Yeah.
But what's the game plan then, right? Because there's, I mean, at least from what I know and what's public, there's no talk of a B-52 replacement. It's, oh, let's upgrade the B-52, let's sunset the B-2 and B-1, and we're going to have a B-52 and B-21 force.
Yeah.
Do you see a future where we only rely on the B-21, or do you think there's going to have to be a non-stealth, cheaper platform that's going to be able to be flown?
Potentially. Some of that is resource constrained. So the old idea, I guess, would be divest to invest. And that's something that has happened actively with the B-1 fleet, right? They struggled with some maintenance deliverable rates there. So I believe it was 2020 through 2021, so into the 21 fiscal year, they went from, I think it was 62 down to 45 airframes. And so it was they like divested of those 17 airframes with the idea that they kept the same number of maintainers at Dyess and Ellsworth. And they went from the 60, they got rid of the 17, you know, least healthy jets, if you will, kept the 45 prime ones, and then poured all those resources into the new ones. And then, you know, with the idea that they're onboarding on the B-21. So divest to invest in that sense. So as they draw down the B-1 and B-2, and then they'll stand up the B-21 at Ellsworth, eventually Whiteman and Dyess, you know, that capability. But right now, so what that does though is you've got, what I say, 45 B-1s, roughly 20 B-2s. You get rid of those 65 airframes, and that leaves 76 B-52s plus the, right now they're talking, I think, acquisition of 100 B-21s. So we're at 176 bomber fleet. But I believe the study that was done a couple of years back that said we need essentially 220 strategic bombers. So we're under our target goal. So that 100 B-21s is kind of a starting point for the B-21 acquisition. So in an ideal world, I think the Department of the Air Force would like to see that number grow as they kind of continue down that acquisition profile. And so down the road, who knows? And technology, I mean, we're talking the next 20 years. So think Right. about where we've come in the last 20, plus the evolution of where our adversaries go and what the current geopolitical threat and climate is.
Yeah, so when we talk about that, I was just looking it up to get the name right. So the H-20 coming from the Chinese, which they're claiming to be basically, as Beijing seeks nuclear parity with Washington. It's part of a description of this news article, right? So, I mean, right now as it stands, how do the bomber's fleet compare? And do you think that the Chinese are actually going to be able to pull off an H-20 that's on par with our technology?
And some of that is the H-20 going to be a B-21 equivalent, which I think some have called it a sixth-gen, you know, aircraft type of thing. So those capabilities are yet to be seen and delivered, but I think it's gonna, everything that I've heard is it's a very impressive platform. Just, you know, digital engineering, open architecture, everything that it can deliver in the years to come is going to be, you know, change the landscape of strategic bombing. So do I think an H-20 can compete on par? I have my doubts. But the bigger picture there is just the strategic deterrence aspect, right? So traditionally, China's had a minimum deterrence strategy, and that's been consistent with their stockpile size, you know, in decades before. But I don't know if you guys saw the Senate Armed Services Committee hearing from, I think it was the end of February, where General Cotton, the current U.S. STRATCOM commander, and he was answering some questions about that. And I think the numbers that were used, so this is open source, was that in the last 10 years under Chinese leadership of, you know, Xi, the nuclear arsenal of China has essentially doubled over the last 10 years. And so it's 100% increase. And over the next, between now and 2035, they're looking at going up to a 500% increase. So, you know, you talk about on parity, numerically, it could be there as far as, you know, their ability, their ground-based threat, especially with the ICBMs there, whether or not they're, you know, sea-launched capabilities or air-launched with the bombers. But their goals of going from the H-6 to the H-20 bomber and going from that kind of regional bomber to the more strategic and intercontinental strike capabilities is definitely going to increase, and they're going to be a player that has to be accounted for.
So the H-6, their current bomber, not very competitive at all. And what's their air refueling system like? They have one, I guess.
Yeah,
I don't know.
I honestly don't know those exact capabilities off the top of my head. It's been a little bit since I've been in the classified environment. But and that's kind of my understanding of what China's, you know, like I said, traditionally they've been more of a theater centric focus, and then their strategic perspective on nukes, on nuclear, you know, weapons was always minimum deterrence. So they're looking more like a counter value type strike. They don't, you know, if you're a counter value type asset, what's the minimum number that you would need? And in theory, it could be as low as one, right? And so as they go from traditional numbers, which I believe unclassed was like in the 200 to 400 range, and as they go to a 500% increase, in my mind, that doesn't necessarily support a minimum deterrence strategy. So they haven't publicly changed their stance, as far as I'm aware. But I think their perspective is definitely shifting, and I think General Cotton's comments, you know, backed that statement up in his testimony. So,
yeah. So as we kind of get into some of the more strategic, you know, looking at the future kind of stuff. You were the aide-de-camp to the Global Strike Command commander. What did you learn there? What kind of experiences did you get from that kind of staff position compared to your flying career before that?
I'd say that the increase in perspective was completely, you know, just eye-opening. I guess that might be a little redundant. But so the year prior to that, and you mentioned it a little bit in the bio, but I got to spend a year as a Global Strike intern. So they have a year-long program for development and education, where we got to go through 3 graduate certificate programs, the Air Force Institute of Technologies, Nuclear Weapons Effects, Policy and Proliferation. And so, you know, everything from calculating the yield of certain nuclear weapons and the fallout to what's the history of nuclear weapons, what roles have they played in different conflicts. And then in addition to, you know, kind of a foreign policy and strategic deterrence degrees through Missouri State University and the Harvard Extension School. And so that year was kind of great to kind of build that foundation. We got to do a lot of different trips. Actually, that was where I first met General Clark, was when he was the A-10 at the Pentagon. Got to go and do a small group conversation with him. We got to walk through one of the Boomer SSBN submarines at Kings Bay, Georgia. Everything. We even got to go out and walk through the SpaceX production facility in California, walk through the Edwards test facilities out there, and see kind of get some program briefs, at least at the secret level. So that was a real eye-opening experience. And then the chance to go, you know, one layer above that or beyond that with the commander of Global Strike Command and hear some of the conversations that were being had at the next level as they were talking about everything from, you know, the programs that they were looking at As far as acquisition and sustainment. So acquisition things, projects that were on the table. So B-52 engine replacement program, the long-range strike option. So that's the replacement missile for the air-launched cruise missile, the nuclear missile that the B-52s carry. The MH-139 Grey Wolf acquisition program, the B-21 acquisition program, Sentinel, so the new ICBM that's replacing, which is, that's a neat conversation to go down even, a very interesting challenge. So to hear some of the conversations that were going on behind, some of the in the more classified spaces, getting to go to D.C., watch him testify in front of Congress, getting to go out to the, if you guys saw the in the news, let's see, was it, I think Lawrence Livermore at the National Ignition Facility, where they just did their first, I think it was like a cold fusion, and they got a net positive energy outcome.
Yeah.
And I had been in that facility, cool. 2 years prior. So seeing that on the news, and it was just that layer, just a mind blowing, perspective change of holy cow, I was there.
All of a sudden from B-52 and kind of your own little cubbyhole to, everything going on with strategic nuclear enterprise.
Yeah, and the commander at the time, his big push to each of the crews out there, because the Global Strike Commander, he is the air component commander for STRATCOM, and so he is in charge of ICBMs and the bombers, right? So that's 8th Air Force and 20th Air Force as far as their respective organized, trained, and equipped numbered air forces. And so getting to see it from that perspective. But what he used to always tell the crews was basically, I don't need you to think about deterrence, right? That's too much of a high level concept to think about day in and day out. He just wanted us to focus as crew members was being lethal in whatever jobs that we were doing. So that is being absolutely competent and capable and credible in those day-to-day roles. And if we are max performing our abilities there as individual crew members doing like the old Bill Belichick, line, do your job. And so if you can do your job as a baseline crew member, then that gives the national leaders, whether it's, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, the SecDef, the president, to go out and actually affect that deterrence policy. So, yeah, it was just a really neat perspective change to go from that crew dog perspective to seeing that.
So when you mentioned the Sentinel, the new ICBMs, so I feel like I'm kind of plugged into what's happening in the Air Force, but I just learned about this like last week, and I was watching, some YouTube video. And so how big of an upgrade is that? And what does that even entail? I know I was watching the video, so I have a few facts, but I don't want to say the wrong thing, but like how big of an upgrade is that? And how fundamental is that to national defense?
So again, I said it, the nuclear deterrence is the bedrock to us being able to do anything else in the, as far as conventional, having that nuclear undertone. I mentioned how much of a game changer, I think, or whatever the verbiage you used. Capabilities wise, definitely can't go into that here, and I'm not read into any of that really, if we're being frank. But if you want to talk about how much of a monumental project that is, holy cow. So three missile wings, right? F.E. Warren, Malmstrom, Minot. And at those, I think open source roughly like, let's say 150 missile silos out there. And this isn't, I mentioned the divest to invest. That is not something you can do with your ICBM fleet.
Yeah, right? We need those.
That if that is the, that's your immediate response, because we don't have B-52s on alert on any given day. And we don't want to have to use the SSBNs as a, immediate retaliation, nuclear option. Their whole game is being survivable. And as soon as an SSBN does a single launch, adversary now knows where they are, or now knows where they are. So we don't have.
And wait, what's SSBN?
Sorry, SSBN. That's the sea launched ballistic missiles. The subs. So that's a Navy entity. And so with the ICBMs, we can't take them offline, right? We can't get rid of a whole mass of them. We can't shut down a missile wing with the idea like, okay, we're gonna now refit and we're gonna redo it, because we're going from 1970s Minuteman III technology to 21st century Sentinel ICBM capabilities. And so even like I said, three wings, let's say 150 missile sites per wing, 450 total. Let's divide that by 52 weeks. You're looking at what, 8+ years if they did one missile a week of just, you've got to take it down. You've got to completely refit the silo, the capsules that go with it as far as where the crews actually sit. So as far as the monumental scale of that project, it's incredible. And so trying to balance that, not only from a logistics side, but also from a strategic aspect of we can, like, that is, if that's the bedrock of our deterrence and Department of Defense, policy, how do you go about that? And so it's a pretty grand scale, especially on the idea that, well, and that all ties into the larger nuclear overhaul of the entire nuclear arsenal, right? So there was a better part of 20 to 30 years where not a lot was done as far as modernization projects. After the Cold War ended, 90s was kind of an era of peace. Then we ended up with a 20-year global war on terror. And so now all of a sudden, I think it was in 2010 when a lot of the nuclear recapitalization and modernization projects started being funded. So under the Obama administration, and it's now we're 15 years post that, but we're now just starting to see some of those policy decisions and appropriations go into effect. But you've got Sentinel coming online, which I already described the scope of that project. The Ohio-class submarines for the Navy are all being swapped out for the Columbia-class, but I don't think that's supposed to be full operational capability until 2042. And if you remember the time horizon that I had said as far as China's modernization was 2035. So we're kind of... Yeah, so like if China is on a relatively short time horizon as far as the Sentinel replacement program, you know, and I threw it out there that it would be one missile a week for 8 years.
Right.
So you start to put all this stuff in there, and that's where that perspective change of getting to serve, alongside the MAGCOM commander for Global Strike Command was completely eye-opening, because you see, you know, he's in the seat for roughly 3 years, and they're working on a five-year budget cycle, essentially. How do you plan for decades out? And it was really neat.
Right, you got to see that dance of, you know, that's why you guys have to be on top of your game as crews, because you've got to be credible while these other things are going through their own refreshments. And I'm sure when B-52J is a thing and re-engining happens, it's going to be more of the same.
Yeah, and so, you know, we're talking 2042 time horizons for the Columbia class, but when we're talking 15 and 20 years, how many of your classmates are still going to be in the service? So it's how do you keep a young crew dog engaged in that sense? So it's that's where, as crew members, it's let's focus on the nearest fight, nearest alligator to the boat, and then let the national leaders focus on that strategic policy.
Yeah. I have a hard time believing they're going to get one per weekend.
But
that's crazy to think. Like, I mean, 1 week to me is a little ambitious, just because, I mean, okay, think logically.
Yeah. And
you can't take them all down at once. No. And so you have to do it slowly, slowly, slowly. And so, I mean, yeah, that is a long, long time period absurd.
And that's not even, it was purely
a
mathematic argument there, but because they'll take, you know, multiple sites and there'll be varying levels, but it's the idea that this is a long, long time, like long time horizon.
So kind of going to your like education, your background, right, before you got to the B-52. So what was it like being a FAPE, and how has it affected your flying career? And
and just a quick note for anyone listening: FAPE stands for First Assignment Instructor Pilot. So right after pilot training, instead of going to your shiny new airplane, you get to stay at pilot training for 4 more years.
It was about 3 and some change for me. Yeah. So I loved it. And I'll lead with that. It was a unique experience that, so I showed up to pilot training, checked in, I think it was like a day 59 of my leave. So I was one of the first guys in my academy class to check in. And they actually said, hey, you've got, somebody medical dropped out of a class. So I got to jump in and classed up. So I was I sat That's casual quick. For 2 or 3 weeks, IFS at the time, initial flight screening. Then about 2 weeks of downtime and then started UPT. So never sat casual for longer than a month. Graduated pilot training, and I'm a member of the 2% club. So meaning that my high school girlfriend and I, we dated long distance the whole time that I was a cadet at the academy, and she ran track back in Nebraska at a Division II school. So dated long distance, got married shortly after graduation, moved to Oklahoma, and she actually got into a physical therapy program at OU. So she's in Oklahoma City, and I'm in Enid at Vance Air Force Base. So at the end of my year-long UPT, which, again, I got there and jumped straight in, I'm now a year done, and she's got about 2 years left of her grad school program. So at that point, best opportunity to kind of keep us in close proximity was either jump on an E3 at Tinker, which wasn't top of my list of things to do,
right?
Or stay and do the FAPE gig. So not everybody wants to FAPE, but it was my number one preference jumping out of pilot training.
I was going
to
say it has a little bit of a reputation.
It can, yeah, maybe a little bit of saltiness that you're not out there, you know, doing the fight and jumping right into an MWS or you know, main weapon system platform. So. But it was my top choice. I loved, so a quick upgrade program. And then I ended up back at pilot training at Vance, and I probably missed flying an instructional sortie as a second lieutenant by, I don't know, 2 or 3 weeks. Wow. Yeah, so I had brand new first lieutenant, jumping into a roughly $5 million aircraft with, you know, retractable gear, 2 ejection seats. And I'm now responsible for the life of a student. Yeah. And my first student sortie, so I'm a 2010 grad out of Squadron 2, and my first instructional student was a 2011 grad out of Deuce, out of 2. Wow. So a guy that I had walked these hallways with, and all of a sudden, he's the student pilot, and we're out there, and I'm teaching him how to, you know, we're doing advanced aerobatics, and then we drop into our auxiliary field, and we had a gear malfunction, so we didn't get safety. So it's my first student sortie with a guy that I knew and was at school with. And then we have unsafe gear indication. So chase ship, high pattern. And that was kind of the realization that it happens fast. You're going to have to grow up quick. And so while a lot of the guys and gals that I graduated pilot training with, they're off and hacking the mish, if you will. And in some sense, that means they're co-pilots in a KC-135 trying to figure out which direction the gear handle goes. And in some cases, they're brand new wingmen in an F-16 or A-10. But for me, it was, you're now responsible for another person's life as in the IP of record, and jumping into that role. And so over the course of those 3 years, I got about 1,200 hours in the T-6. And that came by way of 1,000 sorties. So I actually crossed the century mark there. So, So 1,000 sorties, that's 1,000 briefs, 1,000 debriefs, and the airmanship that was built over the course of that. So that's figuring out, you know, how to be the good defensive flying skills. We talk defensive driving, but right. Defensive flying is how do I try to always think a step or two ahead of, you know, what my wingman is doing when we're in formation or what my student pilot is doing. And then also, you know, if there's class or B or C airspace within 700 miles of Vance, there's a good shot that I've at least done an instrument approach, if not done touch and goes and landed there. So just a chance to see the country and build a lot of that airmanship. And if I could kind of dovetail that into my B-52 experience. Yeah, so sure. I went from the T-6 and then showed up to Barksdale, went through the initial qualification over, you know, 8-9 month program, and then PCS'd up to Minot. Checked in, my squadron was at the time deployed to Guam, so we went through MQT with our sister squadron, and then, so that's mission qualification training. Then my squadron redeploys just right after I had finished mission qualification. So I'm now a checked out B-52 co-pilot, dual seat qualled, so I can sit left seat, right seat, and my squadron commander calls me and he said, hey, you're a FAPE, right? Said, yes, sir. How many hours do you have? A little over 1,200. Cool. Your aircraft commander check rides in 3 weeks. So just, you know, straight to the fire, right? And at that point, did not feel ready. Some of it, probably not the best phrase, but fake it till you make it. So jump right in there. But it with that came a lot of responsibility of, I knew that my B-52 knowledge wasn't where it needed to be, but I was surrounded by awesome aviators. So we've got 4 other members on the crew. They paired me up with a senior co-pilot, so somebody who'd straight out of pilot training, went to the B-52 and had been there for 2. He was the next guy to upgrade, kind of a thing, to aircraft commander. An instructor radar navigator, a relatively seasoned navigator and electronic warfare officer. So it was my airmanship, and they had airmanship too, but that was kind of the thing that I had going for me, at least, paired with their B-52 systems knowledge. And, you know, just a couple of weeks after I upgrade, then I'm generating on a nuclear exercise, if you will, Global Thunder, and generating as an aircraft commander and signing for possession of nuclear weapons. So pretty wild. And then less than a year later, I'm going through upgrade to 3 weeks after that, go down range and fly in CENTCOM as a new IP. So the FAPE experience, as far as building airmanship, building that perspective and understanding, okay, I don't know everything that I need to know, but I owe it to my crew members that they deserve to have a competent aircraft commander. And that's that motivation to, okay, I need to study, not to, you know, further my own career or anything, but it's, I owe it to them and to make sure that we can get the buff airborne and back safely.
Yeah, no, it is crazy. Like academy relationships first. Well, as far as like your first instructional, that's crazy.
Yeah.
But, and then, yeah, 2% club. I mean, God bless you, but I cannot do a long distance relationship.
Yeah,
and so like when we talk about the academy, right, you're back as an AOC and yeah. you help down at the 557th?
Yep.
Okay,
yeah.
Down at the 557th as part of the 306. Mm-hmm. And so what made you want to come back to the academy?
So a lot of it was the experiences that I had had as a cadet. So I had an AOC, he was a maintenance officer, and the things, so I got to serve as the cadet squadron commander in the spring semester. It's one of those things you wouldn't wish it on your worst enemy. Just, it was a great experience. I learned a lot, specifically from my AOC, and it was getting to have some of those conversations with him and developing my leadership perspective and some of those things. And so seeing the impact that he had on my career and how that shaped my perspective to go on and do the things that I did was an opportunity to come back here and kind of pay that forward. There's also an element of that. So still married, coming up on our 14-year anniversary. We've got 3 kiddos. And
congrats.
Thank you. And so as far as assignments, this was a great opportunity. 3 years in Colorado Springs. My wife and I are both from Nebraska, so it's a pretty short trip home to see grandparents. So and when it was an opportunity that I never thought would happen until I stumbled into that aide de camp job. And when I had that strategic perspective of the Global Strike Command intern program plus working as an aide. And then, so I felt like I had this strategic perspective. I had at least gained a glimpse of that. And then this was a program really designed as a leadership opportunity. So a chance to be essentially squadron commander as a major, whereas in the ops world, most squadron commanders are lieutenant colonels. So kind of to hit both sides of that coin of the strategic aspect and the leadership perspective, and then to come back and pay it forward and work with the cadets.
Yeah, so on that note, right, you were squadron commander 2010. What has changed at the academy? I know the answer is a lot, but like, what do you think has changed for the good? A lot has changed for the good, but like, I'll just leave it there. Okay. I'll let you answer the question.
Yeah. I mean, it's one of those things. So I came back and I'll say it is, over the course of this year, there's a lot more that is looking more like what I experienced as far as some of the past structure that I know isn't necessarily popular with the cadets right now. And so some of those things that as those policies and you know different perspectives come back into the cadet wing, that's more of what I experienced as a cadet. So when I first came back and it was essentially unlimited passes for everybody, that struck me.
I mean, that was crazy to me.
Yeah, right? And so trying to get back into some of those things as those policies came back. One of the things that really struck me was the questions that get asked when it comes to training. And it's always why, as in what's the purpose? And so it's one of those things that generationally, I think even I don't feel like I'm that much older than the cadets, but it was one of those things of when I was a cadet, it was like, okay, this is what we're going to do and we're going to go do it. Whereas I think generationally there's been a shift there of, you know, from the millennial generation through the down to Gen Z. And it's more of a, we owe it to you all as, you know, young leaders when developing towards that leader of character framework. We owe an explanation, and if we don't have a good rationale for what we are doing and why, then it's probably not worthwhile to do, right? So trying to explain that, and there's been a lot more why questions of why are you doing this and what are you doing there? And so trying to make sure that we have good tailored objectives to everything that we're doing and that training is purpose-driven. So there's a lot of different things that I think in my time that we were going to do it because we were told to. And that's not always the best answer, right? Tradition is a great and valued thing, but we also want to make sure that we're making the most of your time as young leaders in training and we're developing you intentionally, I think is the big piece, and we owe that to you.
Yeah, for sure. Last question before we get into our ending question. What does the future hold for you? You're an AOC now, your first year AOC, right?
Yep.
So you got another year on command after this school year. Where do you think you're going? Where do you think your career's going?
A lot of that is kind of, you know, balancing the family piece paired with the Air Force piece. But we're right in the heart of having to make some of those decisions. I think the way my timeline is basically set up would be, so I'm a sitting AOC and technically in a command billet, but on the operations side, it's not necessarily like an operation squadron commander. So that would probably be the next step would be I just met my lieutenant colonel board in January. So assuming, you know, if the outcome of that is a promotion statement, then maybe pin on next year, and then that would set me up to go back to a flying squadron and be a director of operations. And then out of that role, maybe fleet up to a squadron command role in a flying squadron. So that's probably the most likely avenue, which would be awesome. Whether that's in a bomb squadron and getting to go back and affect that mission, or my career has, I think, so of the 2,700 hours, I think I'm probably pushing 2,000 instructor hours total, just with the 1,000 instructor hours from the T-6, the B-52, and now pairing that with a little bit of T-53 time. So I'm really passionate about the training mission and going out there and training that. So if I got the chance to go back and even command an AETC as a flying training squadron commander, that would be a great opportunity. And so balancing Air Force, you know, mission and aspirations there with the family aspect. And so trying to find stability for our 8-year-old, 6-year-old, and 4-year-old right now. We're in the thick of it. So we've got a special needs kiddo. So trying to balance some of those considerations too of what's best for them.
Yeah, for sure.
Solid. All right. So we have a traditional last question on each episode. And it's pretty simple. What is the best aircraft in the Air Force's inventory and why?
So I think playing off my experience, and we'll call it the longevity of the longest serving bomber in Air Force history, I think there's an argument to be made there for the B-52 for sure, especially looking at how long it's projected to serve, its future capabilities, and the role that it plays in our national defense strategy. However, the cop-out answer, I would say, is the one that you are effective and proficient and trained in. And I think that was something I always told my student pilots when I was teaching as a FAPE, was everybody comes into undergraduate pilot training with different goals and aspirations. Some of them, you know, I've wanted to be a fighter pilot since I was 5, and maybe that dream materializes and maybe it doesn't. And some come in and they're open-ended and they just want to go and serve and, you know, fly whatever. But the big thing that I've found throughout my career is that whatever weapon system you end up in, pour yourself into that, you know, learning the ins and outs of how to fly it, how to be effective in that mission. And everybody typically enjoys and takes great pride in wherever they're at. And that's been the coolest part of my career, is just kind of seeing the different doors and opportunities that open up. But wherever I am, the old adage, bloom where you're planted. And so trying to make the most of every opportunity, working hard, knowing who you're working hard for and for, you know, what and why. And just if you can get into a weapon system and really just get to know it and max perform that weapon system, that's where you're going to be most lethal, most capable, and contribute the most to our national defense.
For sure. Awesome. Well, sir, thanks for coming on the podcast. We really appreciate you taking your time out of your schedule. This was the Flyover Podcast, episode 19. Thanks again to Major Favinger for coming on. As always, these episodes are on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. We're experimenting with YouTube. Clips are still on YouTube Shorts and Instagram Reels. And be sure to share this with anybody you think would like these episodes. And with that, we will catch you all in the next one.